Good morning, my name is Ruth and I'm one of the pastors at Cedar Ridge. Today we're continuing our series, Stories of Comfort and Hope. In this series, we're looking at a range of Bible stories that concern people who face difficult situations and yet manage to find hope and comfort in God and in one another. Today's story is one that's pretty well known. If you grew up going to Sunday school or if you've read Bible stories to kids, this story is probably familiar to you. It's the book of Ruth. It's a very short book, just four chapters. You can read it in about 15 minutes, although obviously I'll make it last much longer this morning. But it's a great read. It's a lovely story. It's set in the time before Israel had a king, when judges ruled the land. We don't know exactly when that was, but it seems to have been a long period, maybe from about the 15th to the 11th century BCE. So it was a very long time ago. And this was a terrible time for Israel. It was their dark ages. If you read the book of Judges in the Bible, which in the Christian Bible is immediately before the book of Ruth, in the Jewish scriptures the order is a bit different. But if you read that book, that time period sounds incredibly awful. There are tribal wars, there's barbaric oppression of different people groups, very brutal violence, some incredibly horrible treatment of women. I'm not going to go into any details. I don't know how many kids we have in the room, but it's a really oppressive, violent, dark time. And the last words in the book of Judges are these. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Now, although the story is set sometime between the 15th and 11th century BCE, it was probably not written down until around the 4th or 5th century BCE. And scholars think that because of some of the words that are used in the narrative. But it was probably documenting or retelling a story that already existed in oral tradition. And this story is unlike anything else that we have in scriptures from around that time, because it's a story of one seemingly pretty ordinary family. It's not a story about kings or prophets or military leaders. There are no angels in the book. There is no mention of miracles. There's no overt teaching. This is a story of a family. But of course, it's also a story with a purpose. It's included in scripture for a reason. It's just that scholars argue about exactly what that reason is, and we'll come back to that a little later. But let's read the beginning of the story. It starts like this. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they have lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and husband. So as noted at the end of the book of Judges, Israel had no king and everyone did as they saw fit. But then the book of Ruth starts by introducing us to a man called Elimelech, which means God is king. And maybe that's meant to be ironic or it's a protest against the state of things. But either way, this is not actually Elimelech's story, contrary to expectations. And we know that because he dies in verse 3. And actually, the central character turns out to be a woman called Naomi. Naomi is someone who, as we've just read, experiences a great deal of loss. In fact, sometimes she's called the female Job. She, along with her husband and sons, experienced famine that hit them really hard. They lived in Bethlehem, which means house of bread, but there was no bread. Again, rather ironic. The famine was so bad that they were forced to migrate. And obviously that wasn't a decision that people made lightly, to leave behind your fields and home and relatives and to go off to a foreign country was and still is a sign of desperation. It must have been very stressful, traumatic even. It wasn't actually a long journey, it was probably only about 50 miles, but Moab was very different from Israel. Although Israel was in its dark ages, Moab was in many ways worse. Child sacrifices and dehumanizing fertility rights were essential parts of the national religion. And the tensions between Moab and Israel ran high. So it's unlikely that Elimelech and his family would have been welcomed with open arms. And then after they settled in Moab, Naomi's husband died. And she was left a widow, no doubt in deep grief and full of anxiety for the future. And her two sons marry Moabite women. And Moabites were despised by Israelites. We read in the book of Deuteronomy, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation." So just one drop of Moabite blood made you an outcast. Israelites were strongly warned against marrying Moabites or other foreigners. It was totally forbidden. Now, as we've said, this was the age of the judges when everyone did what they saw fit. But still, as a Jewish mother, it must have grieved Naomi to see her sons marrying Moabites. And perhaps Naomi viewed it as God's punishment when neither daughter-in-law managed to conceive. It's not totally clear from the text whether Naomi lived in Moab for 10 years total, or if her sons were married for 10 years. But either way, neither Orpah nor Ruth became pregnant, which of course was a huge deal. The culture of the whole region at that time ascribed value to women in relation to men. Their worth was measured by having a husband and bearing sons. And at the end of these first five verses, Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth have no husbands and no sons. And in addition to the deep grief that they must have felt themselves, they would have also felt this burden of shame from the culture. So we're left with a household of three broken-hearted widows. Widows in that time and culture were extremely vulnerable. In fact, the word widow in Hebrew actually comes from the word for unable to speak. Widows were the silent ones. They were the voiceless ones. They had no assets. Women without a male heir would just lose everything that belonged to their husband. It would be divided up among his brothers or other male relatives. And this still goes on today, of course, in a number of countries. I used to live in Mozambique, and in rural areas, when a man died, the brothers would often come in and take everything, leaving the widow with absolutely nothing. It was awful. But being voiceless, widows had no recourse to justice. Men made decisions, men ran business, men settled legal affairs, not women. And so if a woman had no one to speak for her, no man to speak for her, she could be tricked and cheated at every turn. And the way she dressed in her widow's garb would actually readily identify her as an easy target. So we have three widows, vulnerable, grieving, penniless, and bearing this horrible burden of shame. And the family line has come to an end. All Naomi's so-called success in having two sons has been undone. The name of Elimelech will be forgotten. And so for a Hebrew story, it's all over. We're only five verses in, but there's nowhere to go with this. The men are dead. Naomi is old and beyond childbearing age. So we're done. It should be the end. And yet, obviously, actually, it's just the beginning. The story continues. Naomi learns that the famine in Israel is over, and so she decides to return home. And she urges her daughters-in-law to go back to their family homes. There's no future with her. Why would they go to Bethlehem with her? As foreigners, poor widows, barren widows, they're going to be at the very bottom of society. It's better that they go home to their mothers. And this scene is often depicted in art as one of great love between the three women, as Naomi gives up her claim on them and wishes them nothing but the best. Here's a painting by Marc Chagall, for example, showing the women clinging to one another in a very loving and very tender way. Chagall did a series of paintings on Naomi and Ruth, all in brown and red. And here the brown is dominant as he's expressing their grief. But the glowing red still holds out hope for the future. And there are many other similarly tender portrayals of the scene. Here's a more modern one. But Naomi's words are also pretty pragmatic. She says, "Go home, I've got nothing for you." This painting by Pieter Lastman makes the scene a little bit more ambiguous in terms of Naomi's emotions. But whatever the sentiments expressed, Orpah listens to her mother-in-law, she obeys. She does the sensible thing and goes home. But Ruth refuses, and she makes a vow that's become popular in weddings. We read, Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me, and more as well, if ever death parts me from you. If even death, sorry, parts me from you." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. And there's that ambiguity from Naomi again. Said no more to her. You think that she would have poured out her gratitude to Ruth, but there's no indication of that. Ruth makes this incredible vow of loyalty to Naomi. And we tend to assume it was because she really loved Naomi with, you know, tenderness and friendship, that maybe she viewed her as her own mother. And maybe she did, but we don't actually know that. Maybe it was the God of Israel that Ruth loved. Maybe she refused to return home because that would have meant returning to Moabite religion. Or maybe she didn't really have anything to go home to. We don't really know. But the story continues. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Call me no longer Naomi," which means pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. "For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me? And the Almighty has brought calamity upon me." "Call me bitter," says Naomi. Her speech here is interesting. She says she left full, but of course we know she was actually forced to migrate because of economic distress. The family was driven away through hunger. She says she's returned empty, but Ruth is stood by her side. Naomi seems to view her fullness in terms of her husband and sons. She also says that God is against her. And that, of course, is kind of the tension in the story. This story seemed to end after the first five verses. The family line is doomed. There's nothing worse than that. You know, you've forgotten, you've finished. And yet we're just starting the story. So has God forsaken Naomi? Is she correct? We have to see. That's kind of the point of the story, I think. Naomi seems to ignore Ruth when she arrives back in Bethlehem. She only uses singular verbs and pronouns. But I have to imagine that she's just depressed. She's lost her husband, her two sons. She's got no economic security. She's failed to continue the family line. She's trekked 50 miles or more back to Bethlehem. And at this point, she just seems to kind of shut down. The narrator of the story tells us that Naomi actually has a wealthy relative, a man of standing, or a man of valor, it can be translated, called Boaz. We later found out that Boaz is the grandson of Nahshon, the commander of Judah's army. So he was a bigwig. He was a well-known, well-respected landowner. He's not somebody you would forget. And Naomi also has other relatives in the town, we later learn. And yet, apparently, she does nothing. She doesn't reach out to them. She doesn't seem to do anything. It's left to Ruth to take the initiative and figure out a way to put food on the table. And Ruth does that. She decides that since it's the start of the harvest season, she will go and glean in the fields. Gleaning was established by law in Israel to make provision for the very poor. Landowners were instructed not to harvest all the way into the corners of the field, and to only harvest through the field once, not to go back through and work it again. Any crops that got missed could be harvested by the very poor. This was back-breaking work. Gleaners were collecting the leftover scraps, and depending on how thorough the reapers had been, they could work for hours and gather very little indeed. It was also humiliating work. It marked you out as someone who was unproductive in society. Basically, it was sanctioned begging. And for a young widow, it was also dangerous work. Women working alone, distinguished by their clothes as voiceless widows with little or no recourse to justice, could easily be assaulted. Or robbed at the end of the day of their meager harvest. So this was risky, hard, lowly compensated work. But Ruth had no other options open to her. She and Naomi were desperate. They needed to eat. And Ruth had promised to take care of Naomi, so she went off to glean. The book of Ruth reads, "So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz. As it turned out, it just so happened to be Boaz's field. Boaz notices Ruth and finds out who she is, and also learns that she's been a bit on the cheeky side. Usually, the male reapers went first through the field, cutting the stalks, and then the women workers came behind and they would bundle the sheaves of grain and take them away for threshing and storage. And then the gleaners could come along afterwards and take what was left. But Ruth asked for permission to glean in amongst the harvesters. Maybe she didn't know Jewish custom, or maybe she didn't care. Maybe she just wanted to make sure that she could go home with enough food for Naomi. And for whatever reason, the overseer in charge of Boaz's harvest agrees to let her do that. And he seems to be impressed by how hardworking she is. He says, "She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So the overseer is okay with it. But what about Boaz? It's his field after all. What will he do about this pushy foreigner, a widow, taking crops that she's done nothing to help grow and taking much more than she's legally entitled to? Whether or not she knows it, Ruth is appealing not to her legal right to glean, but to the Jewish concept of hesed. Hesed is a beautiful Hebrew word meaning steadfast love and loyalty and faithfulness to a covenant or a vow. It has a strong relational component. It's not a random act of kindness, but rather it's love and kindness over the long term to someone who has no right to it. It's freely given, and it's often self-sacrificial. And God is often described in scripture as showing hesed. In fact, God says this directly. In Exodus 36, God says, "I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness." The word hesed is only used three times in Ruth, but it's exemplified throughout the whole story. And when Ruth asks to glean among the harvesters, whether she knows it or not, she's actually appealing for hesed. The letter of the law says she's entitled to glean the corners and after the harvesters have finished up. But the spirit of the law is hesed, and hesed says, don't let poor, vulnerable widows go hungry. So Ruth is exposing the need for a greater sense of justice, a more generous spirit than simply what is required by law. But will Boaz rise to the occasion? Let's see. Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." Way to go, Boaz. He did go above and beyond the legal requirements. In fact, he went above and beyond Ruth's request, which was already pretty cheeky. He intervenes to ensure her physical safety, and he lets her drink the water that the men have drawn, which is a total reversal of gender roles. Usually it's women who draw water for the men. He's providing for her in a way that goes far beyond his obligations as a wealthy landowner. The generous response even surprises Ruth. We read, "At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, 'Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?' Boaz replied, 'I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord,' she said. 'You have put me at ease,' or literally comforted me, 'by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants.'" Ruth asks why he is so generous with her. And Boaz praises Ruth's hesed to Naomi. It seems that hesed breeds more hesed. Faithful, loving kindness is repaid in kind. Ruth says she's comforted because Boaz has spoken kindly to her. For all her pluckiness, she is, after all, grieving. think it's important to note here that there's no indication that Boaz has an ulterior motive. This scene is often viewed through a romantic lens, as in this watercolour by Dante Rossetti. We often picture Ruth as a beautiful damsel in distress, and like something out of a Jane Austen book, along comes a rich bachelor to sweep her up and save the day. I think that view actually diminishes the noble and loving acts of chesed that both Ruth and Boaz perform here. As a man of standing, as a wealthy landowner and a devout Israelite, Boaz is very unlikely to view a barren, penniless Moabite widow as a marriage prospect. Furthermore, Boaz is deemed successful. There's nothing about him lacking an heir to inherit his property. If that had been true of him, it would have been a big deal. It's hard to imagine the narrator leaving that out. So it's very likely that Boaz is already married with sons. Ruth has nothing to offer Boaz, and yet Boaz chooses to show Ruth chesed because she too has shown chesed to Naomi. And when it comes time for dinner, Boaz invites Ruth to join him and his servants for a meal. He includes Ruth as if she were part of his extended household. And in a thoughtful act, which is possibly, again, a little bit cheeky, Ruth keeps the leftovers to take home for Naomi. So at the end of the day, Ruth returns home to Naomi full. She has takeout dinner, and she has about 30 pounds of grain, which maybe doesn't mean all that much to us, but according to Babylonian records from around that time, a male reaper made about 2 pounds of grain a day. So Ruth has made out like a bandit. This was a really good day for her and for Naomi. But how does Naomi react? Well, Naomi, we know, believes that God directs everything. So when she suffered loss at the beginning of the story, it must be because God has turned against her. That was a common worldview. And we saw the same thing in Job a couple of weeks ago, as the writer struggled with the issue of why God was sending suffering to someone who was apparently innocent. And of course, many people actually continue to think that God sends, or at least makes a conscious decision to permit certain kinds of suffering to befall different people. And again, I think God's response to Job suggested that things are not that straightforward. But that's how Naomi views things. And all credit to her, she doesn't hide behind religion. She doesn't pretend everything's okay. She's clearly very upset with God. She's wrestling, as we talked about last week. But when Ruth returns home from her first day of gleaning, Naomi doesn't let her painful losses, her grief, anger, depression, blind her to this kindness shown by Boaz. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness, his chesed, to the living and the dead." Naomi sees this as an act of kindness, not just to herself and to Ruth, but also to her deceased husband and sons. She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." What does she mean by that? Well, we already mentioned that gleaning was a social provision in Israel, a means for the very poor to have some economic support, minimal though it was. There were also a couple of other legal provisions that are important to understand in order to figure out what this story is talking about. And the first is the concept of levirate marriage. And that was that if a man married and died without having any sons, his brother had a responsibility to marry the widow and to have a son with her, which would be legally considered the deceased man's son and heir. In that way, the deceased man's name continued, his land stayed in the family, and his widow was provided for. There are numerous examples in the Bible of men not wanting to take on this responsibility. The new wife would be an additional economic burden. If she died without having a son, they would get the brother's land. But if she had a son, all the resources that went into raising the son, taking care of the widow, any investments in that land, that would all pass to this new heir. And heaven forbid that the widow bore daughters, because that would be even more of a burden. So it generally didn't make a lot of economic sense from the man's perspective to marry the widow. And so another form of societal pressure had to be applied, and that was a sense of honor. This was a culture that placed a heavy emphasis on honor and shame, and continuing the family name was considered an important responsibility for a man who valued his honor. We read in the book of Deuteronomy that if a man refused to marry his brother's widow, this is what she should do. His brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled." Now, this might sound odd to us to the point of seeming almost comical, but of course, there was nothing funny about it. A widow without sons was desperately vulnerable, as we've noted, and she couldn't demand that her brother-in-law step up and do his duty. All she could do was shame him if he refused. The second customary practice that we need to be aware of is the role of guardian redeemer, sometimes translated kinsman redeemer. Naomi said that Boaz was a guardian redeemer for the family. And the role of guardian redeemer is discussed in numerous places in ancient Jewish law found in the first five books of the Bible. He was a male family member who protected the honor of the family in one of several ways. He would avenge the blood of a murdered relative, or he would pay off a debt to prevent a relative from being sold into slavery, or he would step in to buy back family land that was being sold to non-relatives. Interestingly, this word kinsman redeemer or guardian redeemer is also used of God as Israel's redeemer and avenger and protector. So Naomi has family in Bethlehem, but no one seems to really be helping her all that much. And that is because they're not required to help her. Levirate law doesn't apply to Ruth because her husband's brother also died. But nor does it apply to Naomi, because even if Elimelech has brothers in Bethlehem, Naomi is old. She's beyond childbearing age. So at this point, no one can marry her and produce a male heir. Similarly, no one has made a claim on Elimelech's land. As a widow, Naomi wouldn't own that land herself. Elimelech's male relatives could divide it up as they saw fit. So right now, there's no danger of it being lost to the family. So Naomi doesn't qualify for help, as it were. Plus the fact everyone's been through a devastating famine. They probably have limited resources to enable them to help. They have to rebuild their own household before they can take on someone else. They might even have felt not all that motivated to help. When things got tough, Elimelech left and went to enemy territory in Moab. We don't really know how the family felt about that. Possibly they disapproved. Anyway, Ruth stays working in Boaz's fields for the next 3 or 4 months until the barley and wheat harvests have ended. At which point, Naomi realizes that she needs to find some security for Ruth. She's not going to be able to glean anymore once the harvests have finished. So how is she going to make it through to next year, to the next harvest in 9 months' time? Naomi has an idea, which she explains to Ruth. We read, "One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, 'My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do.' 'I will do whatever you say,' Ruth answered." So much has been written about this passage, from stereotypes of women as manipulative seductresses to homilies about women humbly lying at the feet of men. But what is actually going on here? Well, this was a culture where polygamy was common, particularly if you were rich. Marriage contracts were arranged with a girl's father, or if he was deceased, her brother, or possibly her uncle. But Ruth has no male relatives to represent her. Boaz has shown a great deal of kindness to Ruth over the past few months, so Naomi tells Ruth to change out of her widow's garb and present herself in a way that indicates she is available for marriage. Now, there's definitely some sexual tension in this passage. Ruth is wearing perfume, which was considered very sensual. The threshing floor where she goes to meet him after dark had a reputation for being kind of like a seedy motel. You know, it was a place where extramarital sexual activity would sometimes take place. Naomi tells Ruth to wait while Boaz has finished eating and drinking and fallen asleep. And this was the end of the harvest, where people were in a celebratory mood, and the drinking could well have been heavy. We don't know that, but it's certainly a possibility that he was, well on his way to being drunk. And she's told to uncover his feet. Now, prim and proper commentators say that the plan was to let the cool night air wake him. But less squeamish commentators point out that feet was actually a euphemism for male genitals, and Ruth may have been very explicit here in her overtures to Boaz. Whatever exactly happened, we don't know. But the plan was clearly to appeal to Boaz to take Ruth as a wife, probably a second or even a third wife, and to provide for her as an act of kindness. Remember, levirate marriage relates only to a deceased man's brother, and Boaz is a relative, but he's not Mahlon's brother. He's not even Elimelech's brother. Boaz has no legal obligation whatsoever, but is being asked to perform this act of hesed, to show loving kindness to Ruth in providing a home for her. But of course, it's also a risky strategy for Ruth. Boaz could very easily have taken advantage of her, and there's nothing she could have done about it. He could just as easily have been scandalized by her actions and sent her away humiliated. It's also important to note, I think, that Naomi seems to have nothing to gain here. She's giving up Ruth. Ruth's been the breadwinner, and Naomi is trying to help her survive, even if that means she's left alone. So Ruth says she will do as Naomi asks. We read on. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." Now, Naomi had said, "Lie there and wait for Boaz to tell you what to do." But Ruth doesn't do that. Being the feisty woman that she is, she tells Boaz what to do. She tells him to save the family as its guardian redeemer. Ruth is still committed to her vow to Naomi. She's not content with just finding a husband for herself. She wants to save Naomi's family. And this was an outrageous request and was very likely to be rejected. Boaz would have had to provide for Ruth and invest resources in Elimelech's land. And then if Ruth had a son, that son would not legally be his, and the land would pass out of his estate to the family of Elimelech and Mahlon. Boaz has already gone out of his way to be generous, but this seems to be a huge ask. And Ruth is also sacrificing herself. Instead of just finding a husband and settling down to start a family of her own, she's offering to be a surrogate for Naomi to continue her family line. Ruth didn't bear any children to Mahlon, so she probably believes herself to be barren. Women were always blamed for infertility. So she risks the shame, the pain of being barren again with Boaz. And if she does have a son, that son won't belong to her, but to Naomi, to be Elimelech's heir. So Boaz is blown away by Ruth's self-sacrificial, audacious proposal. We read, "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater, this hesed, is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character." Ruth is not a seductress or a schemer. She's not looking to manipulate a man. She is doing something that Boaz recognizes as honorable, even more honorable than leaving her homeland and her family to glean in the fields of Bethlehem in order to support Naomi. In fact, Boaz calls Ruth a woman of noble character, Eshet Chayil. The fans of Rachel Held Evans, you know that phrase already. It can be translated a woman of valor. It's what Boaz was called, well, not the Eshet part, he's not a woman, but he was called a man of valor, or a man of great worth. So the narrator seems to be equating Boaz, this prominent, wealthy, devout Jewish landowner, and Ruth, a penniless Moabite widow. Boaz tells Ruth that there is actually a closer relative in town who can act as guardian redeemer, and if that closer relative is willing, then great. But if he refuses, Boaz will step up and do as Ruth has asked. The following morning, Boaz finds his closer relative and sits him down with 10 village elders to hear the case. He says that Naomi is back from Moab and wants to sell Elimelech's land, which is interesting because Naomi has said nothing of the sort. And secondly, as a widow, Naomi probably had no right to sell the land. But this closer relative doesn't argue the point. He just agrees to buy it. But if you buy it, says Boaz, you have to marry Ruth. And again, as far as we know, there's no precedent for this. Ruth has no levirate rights here. And again, the relative doesn't argue the legality. Now, whether that's because he's intimidated by Boaz, or whether it's because he was a good man and he was responding graciously, we don't know. He simply says he doesn't want to endanger his own estate by marrying Ruth. And he removes his sandal, referring back, of course, to that passage we read earlier from Deuteronomy 25. So the relative is doing the sensible thing. He's trying to preserve his own family name. But in so doing, ironically, his name is actually lost. He's just known in the book of Ruth as the closer relative. And in fact, Hebrew scholars often call him Mr. No Name. The story continues. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses." In the book of Ruth, God is referenced repeatedly. The characters in the story are constantly calling on God or asking for God's blessing. But God is only credited with directly acting in the story twice. Once at the beginning to remove the famine from Israel, and once at the end to allow Ruth to conceive. And Ruth bears a son, as we read. "Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." And so the book ends with Ruth giving birth to a child that would one day be the grandfather of the greatest hero of Israel, King David himself. This is a great story, but what's the point of the book? As I mentioned at the beginning, there are quite a few theories about that. Many scholars say this is protest literature against the nationalism of other books from around the same time, books like Ezra and Nehemiah. In both those books, Israelites are told to divorce any foreign wives and send them away. Foreign women are viewed as corrupting influences who should be expelled from the land. But in contrast, of course, this book of Ruth is about a wonderfully loving and kind Moabite who is loyal and faithful to her Jewish family and to the God of Israel, and who becomes the great grandmother of King David. Some scholars say this is also protest literature against misogyny. In this book, Ruth takes the male role in a typical Jewish marriage story. She leaves her family, she travels to a foreign land, she encounters various hardships, she has even water drawn for her, which is often a feature of romance stories, and so on. These are kind of classical love story elements, but the central role is played by a woman. This whole book actually is written in a very feminine voice, a woman's perspective, which is unusual for scripture. Naomi tells her daughters-in-law to return to their mother's house, but the usual phrase is father's house. She casts some shade on men in general in chapter 3, saying men can't rest, but women can wait. The people of Bethlehem describe Israel as having been built not by Isaac and Jacob, but by Rachel, Leah, and Tamar. Women name Ruth's child. Ruth is described as better than seven sons, and so on. The narrator's voice is markedly female. A few scholars even suggest that this implies that it was a female scribe. That's not terribly likely, since exceptionally few women were highly literate, and this is a very well-written book. But apparently, it wasn't totally unheard of, so, it's a possibility. But whether or not that's the case, This is not in any way pro-women at the expense of men. Boaz is not a patsy who gets tricked into marrying Ruth. This is a story of women and men, Israelites and foreigners, working together for the sake of Hesed. In fact, Rabbi Zairi wrote sometime around the year 300, "This scroll is not concerned with either purity or defilement, either prohibition or permission. Why then was it written? To teach you of a magnificent reward to those who practice and dispense Hesed." So to wrap up, what are we to take away from this story? How might it bring us hope and comfort? Well, I think the first thing this story shows is that God cares, always, in the good times and in the hard times. God had not forsaken Naomi, and God cares for everyone, no matter how ordinary or insignificant or excluded we feel. The fact that the story of a poor, childless widow is included in the records of kings, prophets, and military leaders means something. The fact that the heroine is a Moabite immigrant means something. The fact that this story is told with a female voice means something. No one is outside of God's love. No one goes unnoticed by God. Second, we can choose to see ourselves as empty or full. Like Job, Naomi experienced great loss, and that loss was real and overwhelming. And she really struggled for a while to believe that God still cared for her. And for a while, her grief blinded her to what she did have in Ruth, as well as in her community. But at the end of the book, she's still a widow. Her two sons were still taken from her. I'm sure that nothing could ever erase her grief for what she lost, but she also found joy in what she had, in the people who loved her and provided for her. She was Naomi, pleasant, not Mara, bitter. She recognized that she was actually in many ways full and not empty. Third, God brings about Hesed through people like you and me. Although God is only mentioned as intervening directly twice in the book of Ruth, God is clearly at work throughout the whole story, not through angels and miracles, but through the prayers and actions of the characters themselves. In chapter 1, Naomi prays that Ruth will find rest in the home of another husband, but then she comes up with the plan to try and make that happen. Boaz prays that Ruth will find refuge under God's wing, and the word is kanap in Hebrew. But in chapter 3, Ruth asks Boaz to cover her with his cloak as a sign of his protection. And the word used for cloak there is also kanap. God acts through people. So then, let's do acts of hesed. Let's be kinder than necessary. Let's not just settle for doing what's required of us, but to go over and above. Orpah was a good daughter-in-law. She grieved with Naomi in her loss. She offered to stay with her. Ultimately, she did the sensible thing. She went home, and she's not condemned for that. She's just not held up as a model of extraordinary hesed. And similarly, we have that closer relative, Mr. No Name. He seems to have been a decent guy. He didn't try and take Elimelech's lands for himself. He didn't fail to fulfill any legal obligations, but he too didn't go that extra step and risk acting with great generosity and kindness. And then finally, this story illustrates the way in which great kindness provokes more kindness. Hesed leads to more hesed. Boaz was generous and kind to Ruth because he knew she had acted that way towards Naomi. Naomi sought Ruth's happiness through marriage to Boaz, but Ruth used that opportunity to further Naomi's interests and well-being. And so on. Hesed, loving kindness, seems to be contagious in a really good way. We're going to take communion in just a moment. And this concept of a guardian redeemer is, of course, one that seems very appropriate to Jesus. We sometimes describe Jesus as our brother, our family member. And in celebrating communion together, we remember how Jesus embodied Hesed, how he became for us self-sacrificial love. And in eating and drinking, we symbolize our willingness to live the same way. So as we come now to communion, let's pray together. Dear God, we thank you for this story, and the inspiration that it brings. We thank you that you are filled with unfailing love and faithfulness towards us, towards each one of us, no matter how small and insignificant we might feel. And as we eat and drink together now, we ask you, God, to help us see how full you have made our lives. And we ask you to help us to embody chesed, to be kinder than is necessary, to love sacrificially, to be more like Jesus. Amen. Let us eat and drink together as the music plays.